WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walking through the city, I often pass homeless people who appear to be mentally ill. They talk and argue with people who aren't there, and sometimes are lost in frightening delusions. And I wonder, what were their lives like before they were living on the street? One such story is compellingly told in the book The Outsider, A Journey into My Father's Struggle with Madness. It's a memoir by my guest, Nathaniel Lackenmeyer. It recounts how his father went from being a sociology professor to a homeless person who believed at various times that the CIA and FBI were plotting against him and that he was a prophet of God. He died in 1995 of a heart attack, 6 years after Nathaniel had broken off contact with him. After the death, Nathaniel wanted to find out more about what had happened to his father during the years they were estranged, and that led to writing the memoir. I asked Nathaniel Lackenmeyer what his father's life was like when he was at his most symptomatic.
Really, he was exactly what you see on the street. You know, if you see in New York City, for example, you see the guy looking through the garbage and muttering to himself and with a sort of hostile air about him. That's what he was like at his worst.
And what about how he looked?
Also, it's sort of the uniform of the homeless, unkempt, long hair, long beard. He was a very tall man, and he'd become very thin at that point, living on the street. And people had said, for example, that you could see the lice on him at 10 feet away, so very dirty, very unkempt.
You had lost touch with him. In fact, you cut off contact with him with a letter saying, "I cannot live in your world, and you cannot live in mine." What had he done that made it feel so necessary for you to take such an extreme action and remove yourself from his life?
He really hadn't done anything. The irony really was that at that point he was much more stable than he'd been in earlier years, but it was sort of the echo of my experiences with him in earlier years, where he would leave sort of abusive and strange messages on the answering machine, or send strange letters accusing my mother of being part of a plot. And he did restrict me from that. He didn't really include me in his ravings, but that sort of still held sway over my thinking when I was about 20.
And you found it frightening, the kind of accusations that he'd make, the delusions that he'd have?
I did, but at the same time, I'd sort of taken it on myself to, his background was as a sociologist, so there were books in the house, just by chance, on the subject of schizophrenia, and I had read about it, and, you know, I think, looking back now, I think maybe I should have been a little bit more aware of the symptoms and what they mean, but at the time, you know, it's just a sort of a raw experience, and you respond sort of viscerally.
You mentioned the kind of scary answering machine messages that he'd leave. Your mother, after they divorced, basically stopped picking up the phone because these calls were so upsetting. And you found the tapes of these answering machine messages in the basement after your father's death. Maybe you could read one of the transcriptions for us.
Sure. This was a call that took place in right around the time of the divorce. He called the machine and he said, "It's me. As promised, here is the letter. William Casey, Director, CIA. Sir, on or about March 1981, your agency, in cooperation with AT&T, the Pelham Police Department, and numerous other agencies, did try to have me commit suicide in the following manner. My then-wife deserted me at your instigation, taking my son with her. I was forced into isolation by conspiratorial design. The instant coffee in the house had been adulterated with a depressant. I was constantly harassed on the telephone, in my car, on foot by automobiles, and still am. Although unaware of it at the time, I had had this mind-reading technology applied to me, which made my every physical condition knowable to you. As a result of this, I did actively seek ways to kill myself. One evening, I recall searching the bathroom cabinets for razor blades and drugs. At every stage of this process, those responsible were aware of my dire mental state and my active search for available means. Have a good day."
You know, I feel like I've heard that phone call and I've read that letter before, too. There seems to be similar delusions that a lot of people who are schizophrenic have that involve the CIA and the FBI, that involve feelings that their mind is being read or manipulated, or thoughts are being implanted by, you know, an outside group that's trying to manipulate them. Do you ever wonder why there are certain kind of patterns in the delusions that seem to manifest themselves in lots of different people with schizophrenia?
I think the reason that those patterns repeat from person to person are because the structure of the disorder is constant. So the reference points are culturally contingent. So that, you know, 200 years ago it wouldn't have been the CIA because the CIA didn't exist. It's in a very strange, skewed way, the delusions of people with paranoid schizophrenia give you sort of insight into what is in a more mild form, you know, sort of cultural preoccupations or fears of other people. You know, in other words, there are a lot of people who are sort of delusional without being mentally ill who have conspiracy theories, and it's simply, you know, it's sort of more pronounced when you're the victim of the disorder.
How old were you when your father started getting symptomatic and started to frighten you and your mother?
It's hard to pinpoint when the symptoms began because at the time, I think, when he began to feel the pressure, sort of it coming up, he was drinking heavily. And I think that masked the symptoms. But I think it was clear that he was symptomatic in the late 1970s when I was about 8 or 9.
Many of us, when we see homeless people on the street, we wonder, what were they like before they were homeless? Who were they before they got this sick? You know, when we see someone who's homeless and clearly mentally ill, who was your father before he got sick? What were his accomplishments?
He was a sociologist who grew up to a sort of with a working class family in Brooklyn, and went to College of William and Mary, and then got his PhD in sociology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And he was very prolific, publishing articles very early on, and had two books published in sociology, one when he was 28, one when he was 31. So he's very prolific and very, very, very intelligent man. Personally, I think he had sort of problems from an early point. I think he had trouble that nothing you would categorize as schizophrenia, but I think he had a difficult time interacting with people socially. As a father, in the years when I was in the picture, he was remarkable.
Remarkable in a good way.
Yes, remarkable. No, I really think that he saved the best of himself for his work, and he tried to keep his work free of his emerging delusional system and his disorder as long as he could. And the same applied to his approach as being a father to me. He always listened, treated me as an adult without, I think, spoiling me, took things that I said seriously. And there was a playful quality to our interaction and a love and an affection that I think is probably rare.
You've told us a little bit about his paranoid delusions, the ones with the CIA and the FBI. Tell us a little bit more about the delusional world that overcame him.
Basically, it had to do with his work as a sociologist, which sort of remained his principal preoccupation. He was convinced once the symptoms emerged and he really became ill that the involvement of the CIA, the FBI, and my mother and all these different agencies and companies in his sort of controlling him. He thought that there was a conspiracy, but he thought that the reason for it was that it was an attempt to get control of his sociological research. And it's sad because what had actually happened was that the emergence of his symptoms had contributed to the deterioration of the quality of his work, which led to him losing his job. Once that happened and sort of things snowballed, he looked at what happened within the context of his delusional system. So he became convinced that everyone was trying to get control of his work. And basically what it was that if he did what they wanted, in other words, if he did the work they wanted him to do and made that work available to them, and the them is this vague mass of conspiratorial elements, that everything would be returned to him. In other words, you know, my mother, me, his house, his job. So that was what happened.
It's kind of paradoxical that he had investigated schizophrenia. He had even worked as an aide, I think, at a hospital for the mentally ill, in which most of the patients were schizophrenic, and yet he was clueless about his own symptoms.
Yeah, it is. It's actually one of the interesting things from my perspective that I discovered in writing the book and in researching it was that it wasn't a coincidence. his work. He worked when he was in college as an attendant at a state hospital, and also sort of looked at that as an opportunity to sort of bring into play in that environment some of the things he was learning in sociology. And his master's thesis and his dissertation were on schizophrenia, and there actually was a connection, and the connection was that at the time there was a prevalent theory of what causes schizophrenia, which says that it was a particular type of family, and he had that particular type of family and really made that connection. It's clear from different interviews I did that he was aware. I make the argument in the book that although he wasn't suffering from schizophrenia at that point, he saw a connection between his family and difficulties he was having in social interaction, and therefore chose to study that theory, which predicted, and it's no longer widely held, but predicted that the particular family that he grew up in would lead the individual to develop schizophrenia. What happened once he became ill, about 40% of people with schizophrenia are, as a function of their disorder, unable to recognize that they're ill. One of the things that emerges, one of the main problems treating people with schizophrenia, is non-compliance with medication. There's no cure, and different medications have different efficacy, but generally it's limited. But what winds up happening is that people, the 40% of people who have no insight into their disorder, people like my father, what they want, they don't make a connection between the drugs and their improvement. And eventually they get off the medication, and there's a wall they really can't cross. And I guess the important point is that that is not a personal failing, but it is a symptom.
Is this one of the things that made it hard for you as a son, because he didn't recognize that he was delusional, so you couldn't talk about him living in delusions? On the other hand, you didn't want to pretend like the delusions were real and affirm that reality. So what do you talk about?
Absolutely. That was really the crux of what I was going through in my teen years was I couldn't broach the subject of his illness. You know, there are people with schizophrenia with or without the benefit of medication who are aware that they're ill, and those are the people who are going to have the best outcome. He wasn't one of those. And it was it's impossible to ignore, or it seemed to me impossible to ignore delusions that, you know, incorporated my mother and just seemed so outrageous, and at the same time maintain a relationship with him. One of the main discoveries I made in writing the book was that's exactly the challenge that you have to meet, whether you're coming across someone, a homeless, paranoid schizophrenic living on the street who's, you know, asking for change or sits down next to you on a bench, or whether it's a family member. That's exactly the key. The key is to sort of compartmentalize, I think, that part of their world, because the most important thing to remember is that person, no matter how alien they appear to be, has the same basic needs, not only housing and shelter, but they actually need the human contact. They need the interaction. And very often their delusional system will make it impossible to interact with them. And one of the things I learned in the book was, one of the gratifying things is that when my father was homeless, there were people who managed to ignore his delusional system and respond to those more basic needs.
And you think you could have done that?
I think I should have. I do. I think those answering machine tapes and those early interactions echoed in my head for much longer than they should have. And I think I also made the mistake, sort of an adolescent mistake, of using, in a way, exploiting my father's disorder sort of as a way of giving myself definition. I really looked at my entire world really revolved around the fact that I had a father with this illness, and that sort of turned the focus from him to me. And I guess when I was at an age where I should have been able to see past some of that, that's what prevented me.
My guest is Nathaniel Lackenmeyer. His new memoir is called The Outsider, A Journey into My Father's Struggle with Madness. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nathaniel Lackenmeyer, and his new memoir, The Outsider, is about his father, who became schizophrenic and very paranoid, living in a delusional world and living often homeless on the streets. Your father started writing these paranoid newsletters with titles like How to Destroy Freedom and the World, an open letter to the KGB, and the CIA. Did he have a circulation, or did these just not go any further than his typewriter?
Sadly, the newsletters were sort of an extension of his sociology. He first wrote and had his work published by other, by university presses, then began to self-publish his own writing that wasn't really delusional as he got into more and more trouble with academia. Finally, he wound up self-publishing these newsletters and, you know, putting ads out and sending out mailings. And in doing that, he exhausted a lot of his financial resources. His hope was that if he could get through to people, if he could get the public to recognize this conspiracy for what it was, they wouldn't stand for it. So it was really sort of a calculated gamble on his part, where he really exhausted his ability to protect himself financially in doing this. Ironically, yes, the people did order them. There's still university libraries that have them. And after he moved, the publishing, the business was in my parents' home, that address. So after he moved, letters would still come in ordering these delusional newsletters. And some of them were from people who I don't think would necessarily be categorized as mentally ill, but who nevertheless found compelling conspiracy theories and things like that. I'll say one other thing, if you don't mind, yeah?
No, please.
Okay. One of the hardest things, I guess, in my early teen years was, as these newsletters came in, I sort of read them, struggled through them. They were very erudite, the writing, you know, the vocabulary, it was all internally consistent, so you could make head or tail of them, and I did eventually. But one of the hardest things was that he self-distributed them, but to many, many people. So, in other words, family, friends, teachers where I was going to school, everyone wound up receiving these things. And actually, as a function of how widespread his distribution of these newsletters was, he, the FBI and the Secret Service began to keep a file on him. And, you know, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. His newsletters were so widespread that he did come to the attention of the government.
Within a year before your father died, he was committed and put on new antipsychotic drugs. Let's talk about how he got committed. He had a commitment hearing. How did he end up in that position?
He was living in New Hampshire for a period of 7 years or so, moving around a bit, and had been institutionalized twice in New Hampshire in the mid-80s. In 1992, it looked like, from his perspective, it looked like he was going to be committed again. His condition was deteriorating. He was acting out in public. And what he did was he jumped the state line. He moved from New Hampshire to Vermont as an attempt to confound his psychiatrist and caseworker's attempt to get him institutionalized. And they only missed him by about a month. They actually came to his apartment and tried to get him committed, but he'd moved across the state. What happened once he moved to Vermont was that, in an attempt to bring him back to New Hampshire, where there was sort of a system in place to help him, his legal guardian took control of his Social Security, his disability benefits. At that, in all those years, he was living on about $10,000 a year, a combination of SSI and his pension from his years of teaching. And so for the year that he was living in Burlington, Vermont, he was living on about $250 a month. What happened later, as he sort of decompensated, as he became worse, he was no longer on medication, he started acting out more and more, and that had the effect of the banks closing their doors to him, and ultimately him not receiving his pension, the last part of his income. So sort of it became, you know, a narrower and narrower pass, and ultimately he could survive only by panhandling. And it was on a panhandling charge that he was finally arrested and brought before a judge and then committed.
When your father was facing his commitment hearing, he kind of on cue demonstrated how delusional he really was. What did he say to the judge?
When the judge was just about to pronounce sentence on him, that is, that he was not guilty of panhandling by reason of insanity and to have him committed to Vermont State Hospital, he interrupted her and said, "May I make a statement?" And she said yes, and he pronounced his sentence on the court before the court had an opportunity to pronounce sentence on him. And part of what he said is, he said, "You know, none of this is real. You have no authority over me. I'm the commander in chief. In other words, at that point, he identified himself, you know, I guess as being the president of the United States, and therefore that all of the proceedings were a farce. And interestingly, at the end, he said, you know, and that is reality. He knew they were offering one version of reality. He was offering another, and it was being recorded for the public record. And I think he had an active sense of wanting his side being heard, just like he had earlier in the newsletters. And at the end, he said, Charles W. Lackenmeyer, Ph.D., sort of as a verbal signature. And I think that was an attempt to announce to the court his history, his record. One of the difficulties, I think, for the homeless, mentally ill population is not only is their present and future really at jeopardy, in disarray, but past accomplishments aren't recognized as they are for most people. You can drift, but you can always lay claim, I guess, to what you've accomplished or to your degrees. And the problem is, you know, because most of what my father said was delusional, people on the street assumed everything was. And I think when he got into that court, he was sort of an act of defiance, and from my perspective, an act of tremendous dignity.
Nathaniel Lackenmeyer is the author of the new memoir, The Outsider, A Journey into My Father's Struggle with Madness. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nathaniel Lackenmeyer. His new memoir, The Outsider, is about his late father, a former sociology professor, who became homeless after he was overcome by the symptoms of schizophrenia. After your father was committed, he was placed on antipsychotic medication. Now, this was during a period of his life shortly before his death when you were not in touch, but during the course of your investigation of his life in his later years, you learned a lot about what happened to him. So what did you find out about the effect that the antipsychotic medication had on his condition?
His condition improved greatly. It depends on the drug, and different people respond to different medications differently. But the effect it had on him, I think, is not atypical, which is that his delusional system remained intact, and he may or may not have been hearing voices. He did not gain insight into his disorder. And again, he was part of this core group that really doesn't seem to be able to recognize that they're ill. And the effect it had was he still, believed his delusional system, but it became less important to him. He wasn't fixated on it. He was able to have normal interaction with staff, with other patients. It sort of became, I think, more of a conventional belief system, like you or I may believe in different gods or what have you, religious or even cultic beliefs, but they don't impede our daily functioning. And I think that's what happened. From a functional perspective, he was much more able to interact, to survive, to... what happened in terms of practical effects, he again turned his attention... He turned his attention for the first time in a while away from the focus on the conspiracy and began to think again about his earlier sociology and to try to do that. One interesting thing that happened at that point that I think reflects how much his condition had improved was there was a staff member, a psychiatric aide at Vermont State Hospital, who was taking graduate classes in psychology, and he was able to help her rework a paper that she'd had trouble on so that the grade could go from an F to an A or something like that. But, you know, basically he was able, at least in that limited context, to return to his former state as a professor.
Would you say in retrospect that being committed helped him?
If my father hadn't been committed in Vermont when he was, the consensus from the people I interviewed, police, caseworkers, bartenders, is that he would have died on the street. This was the winter of 1993, one of the hardest, most severe winters in Vermont history. And the consensus, time and time again, people would say, you know, I thought we'd go out there and we'd find him glued to a park bench. So I think he'd gone, and he was 6'4". His weight went from 220 to 140, the lice, and he had frostbite when he was committed. The commitment process was an attempt to really on the part of the various mental health agencies and the police and even people at the bank that had stopped collecting his check, was an attempt to save his life. They arrested him on a panhandling charge, not because it had done anyone any great harm, but because it was the only way to get him before a court, which speaks to the issue of criminalization among the mentally ill. I don't know if you want me to get into that or not.
Yeah, no, you bring this up in your book, that you think that the... difficulty now in committing somebody against their will has led to the criminalization of the mentally ill. So why don't you elaborate on that?
Yeah, what happened to my father in Vermont was at once a testament, really, to the people in the community, their ability to care. I mean, they knew he was going to die on the street, so they did what they had to get him committed, which, the way things work at this point, it's much easier to commit someone through the criminal courts than through the civil courts. So they arrested him for panhandling. He was judged incompetent and sent to the state hospital. The problem with this, from sort of a broader perspective, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful that they did that. But from a broader perspective, the problem with that is it inflates the statistics of criminal behavior on the part of the mentally ill. In point of fact, he, like most homeless mentally ill, work extremely hard within their delusional system to not act out, to not become violent. And acts of violence, despite media attention given to them, are very rare.
Your father basically died of a heart problem. Shortly after he was released from the institution, he was at that point, I think, still on his antipsychotic medication and was able to be more functional. So instead of living on the street, he was living in a shabby apartment. His body was discovered, slightly decomposed in this shabby apartment. It took a while before his body was discovered. After his death, you kind of investigated his life, talked to the police who found him, talked to a local bartender, to neighborhood people who knew him as the local homeless guy. I'm wondering if you got a general sense of how he was seen by others, if he was seen as, you know, the local homeless guy who people had to look out for, the local homeless guy who was a threat and had to be kept at a distance. Like, what were the perceptions of him?
Different people responded to him differently depending on the context in which they met him. There were many people, and I don't really document this in the book, who I mean treated him really very, very poorly, because it is so easy to remove yourself. It's so easy to look at the homeless mentally ill as a separate species because of their uniform and their strange behavior, that you don't think, it's very often you don't think you have the same obligations you have to them that you might have to a stranger in a suit walking down the street going to work. But this was one of the most really personally gratifying things I discovered in the book, was that there were many people, a handful of people, which, given how limited his social contact really was, is many people. There were many people who gave him things, and most importantly, gave him a sense that he was not living in another world. There was a student who sat down next to him on a bench, and they sort of started up an interaction from time to time where the student would give him cigarettes, but the student would also sit and listen to him. There was a woman at one of those Subway delis who would let my father sit there despite the odor, the lice, and would give him free coffee. And, you know, a lot of times what allowed these people to have their tolerance is something that perhaps maybe isn't so good. For example, the student, I think, made the mistake of romanticizing him and thinking of him as sort of a seer, that if you're crazy, you're also a genius. And I think he looked at it in sort of a literary perspective. But ultimately, what he did was he offered him something. Probably the most moving thing for me in terms of who interacted with him and who didn't when he was in Burlington on the street was another homeless man who, much higher functioning, not a victim of the same disorder, who, you know, started telling me that my father would sit down next to him and begin ranting and raving about the CIA, talking in this sort of fast clip and angrily. And I asked him at one point, it just occurred to me, why, you know, this homeless man was clearly sort of annoyed by my father and his presence and yet would sit with him, you know, day after day. And I asked him, why did you sit with him? Why did you sit with him? And he said, you know, there's times you need someone to talk to. He knew, and he went on and he said that, you know, I think it made a difference. I could feel that even though what your father was saying didn't change and the tone didn't change and his comportment didn't change, that it had an effect. And he said, you know, I helped him. At least I think I helped him. And I think that's telling.
Nathaniel Lackenmeyer, his new memoir is called The Outsider, A Journey into My Father's Struggle with Madness. Coming up, Steven Greenberg talks with us about his father, baseball star Hank Greenberg, who's the subject of a new documentary. This is Fresh Air.